Hello, everyone. Here we are continuing with the essence of the Bhagavad Gita by Swami Kriyananda based on Paramahansa Yogananda's interpretation. So we are up to chapter 4 of the Gita, and in the book we are in the science, the supreme science of knowing. Is that what it is? The supreme science? I have to put on my glasses. I'm pretending I can read it without it. Yes, it says the same thing. The supreme science of knowing. Of knowing God, or just generally knowing. The supreme science of knowing. I guess that's what it is. Okay, let's now begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, Divine Friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to feel your presence and your inward guidance. Let us go deep into this scripture so that even a few words of this infinite wisdom will enlighten us and guide us and help untie the multitude of karmic knots that bind us to this world. Help us to find our freedom in the Divine Spirit. The joy, the fulfillment, everything we're seeking can be found in God. Guide us and bless us that we awaken quickly to this divine truth. Om peace. Amen. Okay. Let's do it. So, chapter 4, stanza number 9. One, O Arjuna, who by intuition comprehends the truth of my divine manifestations and selfless deeds in this vibratory universe, will never again, after he leaves his body at death, need to incarnate in outward egoic form. Soaring in freedom, he will attain me. So he uses the words freedom and he uses the words ego here. One who by intuition comprehends the truth of God. We keep incarnating in this world because we don't understand. We haven't learned the lesson yet. It's just it's an endless mystery. I've been having my minor existential crises lately, just I think because this is in 2020, November, and there's a certain sameness to the days. They're busy. I'm doing a lot of broadcasting and recording and doing various classes and working with a class about the Bible. I've been trying to expand the ministry that I'm doing. I've set up a Patreon page, which is a way for people everywhere to help support the ministry. The work that I've been doing on behalf of our masters has gotten too big to be supported by a volunteer staff, which has other duties. So I've had to, for the first time actually in the time that I've been doing this kind of work, I've actually realized that I have to generate income of my own in order to hire people to be able to help support, because I can do this part of it, but there's a huge technical side of it, which is more than I can do. So I've set up this Patreon page and people are helping make everything work better. All of that is happening. But in between, and I hope I don't bore you by mentioning this again, there's the inescapable reality of being, which it's strange, at least in my own mind, how intensely that looms at times. It's a road to mental imbalance, so I have to always be a little careful that I don't think about it too much. But just the strangeness, and perhaps others of you will relate to this, and maybe I'm just giving you a look at my lunatic mind, but one wakes up out of sleep, and then immediately there's consciousness again. I mean, there's a different consciousness in sleep, but it's different than waking consciousness. And there it is. And I have certain affirmations and reminders just right in my room and on my wall in art, the form of art, in the form of words, so that as soon as I wake up, my consciousness is drawn as quickly as I'm able to draw it. toward elevating thoughts. And there's a certain, well, this morning it was just exactly how I thought about it. You know, one thinks about, you know, what responsibilities do I have today? How quickly do I have to rise from bed? How much of a hurry am I in? All these different things. But I realized very deeply, it's just a minute of consciousness at a time. And there's never a time when it isn't only about consciousness. I mean, we might think we're doing all these other things, and that's as we go through these verses tonight, action, inaction, right action, wrong action. All of these different realities are there, but it's just, where is my attention in this moment? Who do I think I am? What am I thinking about? And Swami just draws the connection here. He says, after he leaves his body at death, no longer needs to incarnate in outward egoic form. Soaring in freedom, he will attain me. So Swami just puts these two words next to each other, the word ego and the word freedom. Some people think that freedom is the ability to do whatever you want, but the Gita, of course, takes this into a far more profound level. It's the freedom from all limiting identification. And it's a monumental shift that I was talking about it with a friend recently, and Swami talks about it here too. As we come closer to our spiritual, as we move deeper into our spiritual self, and even with the little bit of experience that I've had, I can speak to this. What happens when we're in tune spiritually is that we're simply happy. It's like limiting conditions are taken away from us, and we discover when limiting conditions are taken away, what's left is just this joyous sense of rightness. We all have these experience of times in our lives when just everything feels right. And that all the everything that troubles us, it's not exactly resolved, it's just not relevant anymore. This is what the Gita is trying to say. Let me read the next verse, because the commentary is exactly what we want. 4:10, purified by ascetic wisdom, released from attachment, fear, and anger. So, purified by wisdom, released from attachment, fear, anger, and completely absorbed in me, many have attained oneness with me. I was thinking about Swami Kriyananda's, this is an experience that happened a number of years ago. I was thinking about Swami Kriyananda's song, I Live Without Fear. And though green summer fade and winter draw near, my Lord, in your presence, I live without fear. Through tempest, through snow, through turbulent tide, the touch of your hand is my strength and my guide. I ask for no riches which death can destroy. I crave only thee, thy love and thy joy. And I was thinking, what would it be like to want absolutely nothing? And therefore, what would it would be like to fear nothing? Because fear is intimately tied to likes and dislikes. Attachment, fear, and anger. Those are the three that go together. I want things to be a certain way. And of course, from the human perspective, everybody will just say, yes, of course, I want things to be a certain way. But if we understand that everything in creation is just a play of God and it's happening according to God's will, that doesn't mean that we have to be passive in our response to it, but we're only attached to being a channel for the divine. We don't need the world to be different than it is. We don't need anything to be different than it is. We're not attached to anything. And where fear arises is when we really want things to be a certain way. And so then we become fearful, because what if they don't turn out that way? And almost always, virtually always, if you're living a life that has any dynamic involvement in the world, then there's always going to be something going on about which we are trying to bring a certain outcome. And what Krishna says here, he doesn't say that we shouldn't act, and that's what we get into later. It's attachment. We should be committed and do our best as we feel guided to do, but really, we leave the results in God's hands. Now, this is easy to say. I mean, I examine my own heart when I wake up in the morning and when I fall asleep at night. And, you know, they're just countless things that just vibrate right on the edge of my consciousness and sometimes vibrate right in the center of my consciousness to keep me awake, which is attachment to a certain outcome, fear that that outcome is not going to come about. And then anger arises when the desire is thwarted. But what does he say? Released from attachment, fear, and anger, and completely absorbed in me, which is what would happen if we were released from attachment, fear, and anger. Now, it's let me just think what I want to say. Oh, yes, I was saying, talking about, I was contemplating all these things, not this particular verse, but Swamiji's songs. I live without fear. And I was contemplating the consciousness of a master. I was thinking, at that time, I wouldn't have had it as a reference point, but the way Swamiji was at the end of his life, he was so overcome with an awareness of the bliss of his own nature that just everything else just... It was really like he didn't really see anything else. Everything else was just the flow of this bliss that was always moving through him. Well, this was before that stage of Swami's life, and I was just thinking about it. And I was walking up the stairs. It's the oddest time when these things come to you. And I was thinking about what it would feel like to be absolutely unafraid. And like for just, you know, less time than it takes for me to say it, it was like that freedom just popped into my heart. And it was like, for a moment, I was released from attachment, fear, and the consequent anger of it. And, oh my, that is really where we're trying to go. And we just touch into it intermittently. But those little moments of it, whether it comes in meditation or walking up the stairs or standing out in the forest, I was recently... with a giant redwood. And I just, when, you know, they sometimes have all these little nooks and crannies, and I just slipped into a little cranny and just meditated there for half an hour or so, back up against the tree. You know, the tree's rhythm is really different. And that tree had been there for 1,000 years, I think. Just a very, very, very long time, very big. And it's a living, breathing entity. But of course, its rhythm is so different. You know, how many lifetimes of mine have come and gone and come and gone, and that tree's just been quietly building its reality. You know, these are the emotional, mental, spiritual exercises that we need to incorporate into our moment-by-moment consciousness, because released from attachment, fear, and anger, and absorbed in God, then the ego leaves and the freedom comes. Now, Swamiji makes the most interesting comment about this. He says, you know, that the effort, he contrasts the effort to find God with, for example, he says, the climbing of Mount Everest, because we see the attainment of God as this huge, heroic effort that's going to require everything we have in order to attain it. And there's a natural, when we do that, there's a stiffening of the will and a hardening of the determination, you see, just even when I say it like that. So Swami talks about climbing Mount Everest. He said the hardest part is the end. The hardest, the most dangerous, the most life-threatening part is like the closer you get to the top, the harder it becomes. You can't breathe, you're freezing, you're exhausted, all these things. So we think of the, you know, if now that I'm serious about God, we have to gird our loins in that same way. And yes, there's a lot that also speaks to the necessity for courage and heroism. But what he also says is, finding God is the simplest, most obvious, and most supremely natural thing in the world. At the end, one doesn't find oneself straining with desperate, heroic zeal to merge in him. He says, rather one relaxes supremely into perfect bliss. Strain, tension, ardor, heroic zeal, these for the soul end forever. Is this just like the human mind plays a very different game, doesn't it? We imagine that what God wants of us is to wind ourselves up more and more tight like a spring. But what we actually have to do is release all of that. I can't say that I know this from experience, because I don't, but I have intermittently you find yourself in that state of what you can only call effortless bliss, which is not effortless, but in the moment it's effortless. Because the thought just crosses your mind, what do I ever worry about? There's a wonderful story in the book, Swami Kriyananda as I Have Known Him. And in the story, the man talks about, let's see what happened. Well, he talked about first that he fell, had a severe bump on the head, and his soul was exiting his body. That's what he was talking about. His soul was exiting his body. He started up the tunnel of light, and in this experience, he came into the presence of a being of light. That's what he described. And he described, he had read the words, because he was a devotee, he had read the words, the state of desirelessness, which is another way of saying being freed from attachment and fear, which is that absolutely I want nothing. Again, these are wonderful things to contemplate. What would it be like to want nothing? And that, not a negative state, but just be, why would I want anything? What could I possibly want that I don't already have? I put it in terms of, what if I were completely without fear? Fear is a bigger issue for me than desire. I mean, not that I have no desires, but fear is the operative word more in my life. So I started thinking about, what if I had no fear? He was talking about being in a state, he understood the word desirelessness. And he, this is what he described. He said, in the presence of that being, he said, it wasn't merely that I didn't have desires, it was impossible for the vibration of desire to exist in the presence of that being. It's just they contradicted each other. And so in the presence of the being, there was no possibility of want. To finish that particular story, he then talks about the first time he met Swami Kriyananda, or soon after he met Swami Kriyananda. And he asked permission to touch Swami's feet, because this was in America before Swami was living in India. And Swami rarely allowed that, but he allowed him to kneel at his feet. And I believe he touched his feet, but he was kneeling at his feet. Then he looked up at Swami, and Swami was right with him, looked into his eyes and blessed him at the spiritual eye. And the man said he immediately went back into that state, that same state of just sudden and complete, and the word for it is freedom. Because the word ego, the word desires, the word fear, the word attachments, they're all involved with each other. Because the ego takes the infinite spark of divinity, which is myself and all of us, each one of us, it takes that infinity and it wraps it in a bundle of limiting self-definitions. And those self-definitions are all associated not with the eternal, but with the fluctuating world. And the nature of the fluctuating world, by definition, is that we must always be afraid. Because if we're attached, if we're identified and defined, because by definition, nothing is going to last. So sooner or later, the waves will equalize. That's one thing that will happen. And sooner or later, it will change. And if I'm attached to it being one way, sooner or later, it will change. So there's always that subconscious awareness. I remember, I've never had children in this lifetime. I believe I've had many children. I sort of understand what parenting is in a certain way without doing it this time. But I, at Ananda Village, when I was living there in the early 70s, the building which is now Hansa Temple, which sits up on a hill, and you overlook what we euphemistically or humorously would call downtown Ananda, which was just a few buildings in the market. It's the farm, the center of the farm. Downtown is a joke, but that's what we called it. And at that time, there was a balcony on the front side of that building, and we would go out there and sit and have noon meditation, and you could basically look out and see the whole farm from there. We called it the farm. It's the community, the village now. And I remember sitting there, and I was, I don't know how many, like 500 yards away from the downtown area. And I remember this man pulled up in his car and got out of his car, and he was maybe 50 yards or 100 yards from where the market was, maybe 50 yards. And then his daughter, who I happen to know, the whole family, the daughter was maybe 5, beautiful, adorable child. She sees her father, and I can hear all the way up on the hill. She starts calling like little children do, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And then she just races across that distance. He spreads out his arms. She jumps into his arms, you know, and he does those wonderful daddy things that I remember my daddy used to do to me when I was a little girl that are just absolute pure joy for both of you. And I watched, and it was very touching, actually. It brought tears to my eyes. But I also thought, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, here we go again. Not just the little girl, but how could he not grow to desire that kind of wonderful adulation from that innocent little soul? And of course, I'm a grown-up girl, and I had a daddy, and I used to treat my daddy like that, but not for a long, long time. You know, because it just changes like this. So the ego identifies with these limiting conditions. It doesn't merely experience them. It doesn't merely say, oh, in this life now I'm a father and I take care of this child. I'm glad God wants me to take care of this child. The ego begins to identify with it. And as soon as we identify with it, then our freedom, I don't mean freedom to just go and do what you want. That's not the kind of freedom. Our inner freedom from all limiting conditions and our release from attachment and fear, just to that extent, it gets bound. And so when Swami talks about this, we get so confused by all these things, but Swami says it's not effortful. When you finally see it, I remember Swamiji talking to us. He was talking to a whole group of married couples. And he said himself, he said, I understand that you're all married. And he said, but once that desire for a human mate, he said, once it leaves you, and Swami was talking about the fact that it had totally left him, he said, you can't imagine why you ever wanted such a thing. And he just sort of looked at us ruefully, and we all said, all right, we believe you. We can't imagine it until we're released from it. That's such a wonderful word. We're released from it. And then it's just effortless relaxation. Oh, I know what I was going to say. He said, what is left is Satchidananda, ever new bliss. This was the last image I wanted. And see, this is what we don't understand. I'm just musing with all of you about this. I can't present these as imperatives because this is what I wake up in the morning and think about before I start my day. I remember a cartoon, some vivid cartoon image in my mind from a child watching television, I guess. There was some cartoon that had a diving bell in it, you know, like a cartoon diving bell that's shaped, I guess it's shaped like a bell, and it goes down deep underwater, and, you know, it was part of something or another. So I have this cartoon image of this diving bell. And then I have it's all mixed up with movies about submarines and divers and things like that. And how in the submarine movies, you know, everything is fine inside the submarine, but they're way underwater. And of course, there's this tremendous pressure from the ocean around it. And somewhere in the submarine movie, it always happens, something punctures the skin of the submarine. And then there's this, then the movie turns into everybody screaming and running from end to end in this very small space and all the water trying to come in. That becomes the drama of the movie. Because the water is working so hard to get inside of the submarine because the pressure is so intense. Well, these pictures merge in my mind, and I sometimes think of the ego as like that little cartoon diving bell. And then I think of the scary movies where the ocean is trying so hard, but the ego, the diving bell, has to work so hard to keep the ocean out. Whereas in fact, it's the love of God and the freedom of Satchitananda that's trying to break through. And so, whereas we think we have to strain for God realization, this is what Swami is saying, we actually just have to release ourselves from attachments and fears. And how do we do that? Well, we do it a minute at a time. That's about all where I've come to after a lot of life. I often quote, because it's so powerful to me, Master said, take care of the minutes, and lifetimes will take care of themselves. And that's sort of what I think when I wake up in the morning. Well, there's going to be a whole bunch of minutes this day, and every minute I will have a choice where I'm going to put my consciousness. And by no means am I able to always keep it where I want it to be, but when fear and attachment and frustration, if it rises to anger, begins to move in, it's like, no, these don't belong to me. I don't want to identify with. I need to be committed. I need to do my best. But it's in God's hands. It's His party. So, number 411, chapter 4, stanza 11. O Arjuna, in whatever way I am approached, in that way do I respond. All men come by whatever path to me. And 4:12, those who work to fulfill their earthly desires worship the gods, which are ideals in various forms, not idols, aware that success of this kind can be reached with relative ease. So, you know, most people don't think of success on the earth as being available with relative ease, but compared to God realization, apparently it is. And, you know, that's what we worship, and so that's what we attain. If we see success in one way or another. I saw a picture in the newspaper, and it was a picture of some starlet who was really trying hard to become wonderfully famous, and she had some costume on, and I think it was leopard skin. Just artificial print leopard skin or something like that, which increased the jungle feline nature of her appearance. And she just had an extraordinary face. It was just a photograph. I have no idea who she was. She had such an extraordinary face and such an extraordinary manner. And you could see her very sensual, voluptuous body, and you could see her face and her hair. And I looked at that picture and I thought, my gosh, how many incarnations has she been working on this? You know, you don't come to that kind of perfection with that kind of a look just by one incarnation. You have to keep coming back, and you have to keep coming back. And I can't say whether she ever became famous or not, but she was determined. So what is the God that she's worshiping? The God she's worshiping is feminine beauty, feminine sensuality, you know, dramatic magnetism, whatever it might be. I was so amused. I heard a speech by Meryl Streep, who is a very, you know, extremely famous and remarkably talented female actor in America. And she was presented some kind of award for lifetime achievement in the field of theatrics and movies, whatever it was, well-deserved, of course. And she gave this little acceptance speech. And she said she really wanted to thank her parents. And she said, she spoke about her father, who was this, you know, handsome, magnificent, charismatic person with tremendous imagination and drive and all the success he had in life. And then his mother, her mother, who was aristocratic and dramatic and noble, she said, and they were married for how many years together, and they fought every single day. And I want to thank them for introducing me at such a young age to drama, she said. I bet. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's exactly right. That's what you wanted. That's what you became. She was making it as if it were humorous, and perhaps it was. But it was just like, you know, from the beginning of my life, I saw the human story just being acted out, and then she followed through and became magnificent at doing it. And what do you have at the end? Well, you have a lifetime award for bringing a lot of people a lot of very interesting entertainment. It's not nothing. And she undoubtedly developed a tremendous number of qualities. I don't know the woman. I'm not talking about her specifically. But what happens is, when we reach the end of something like that, insofar as we have developed right character from doing it, insofar as the experience of the effort to do it has trained our will, trained our capacity to endure, to concentrate, to serve, whatever qualities of consciousness that effort to success has developed in us, then those we have forever. And if the effort for outward success has taught us something deep and profound about inward reality, then we really have something. But otherwise, there you are. You have this big night, everybody thinks you're wonderful, and then you go home. And there you are. You're inside your own head. You're inside your own consciousness, and that's all you have. So what Swami comments here is people go from one fulfillment to the other. One of my early attempts to convert someone to the spiritual path, I did what lots of newbies do, that for some reason, people quite new to the path sometimes think that the idea of overcoming desires is an attractive sort of like lead when you're trying to persuade people to come onto the spiritual path. It's exceedingly misguided, I advise you. Most people are not really looking to overcome desires. They're looking to have them fulfilled. And a path that tells you you're supposed to overcome them is not attractive to most. But I was a newbie and I was trying to talk. And I was, for me, this made perfect sense because I was born with this awareness that the promises that the world were giving me were false. But I didn't know where the true promise lay. I just knew that the ones that were offered to me were false. And so I was just hanging on this precipice of extreme concern about how this was all going to work out. And then, of course, God rescued me and showed me that there was a true promise. So anyway, so I'm talking to this friend of mine, and I'm talking about how worldly fulfillments are just inherently disappointing. What an opening line. What could I have been thinking? But anyway, I started like this. And I said, you know how it is? You really want something, and then you work hard for it, and then you get it. And then, you know, when you finally get it, you have it for a while. It makes you happy for a while. Yes, yes. But then, you know, after it just becomes common. You know, your new car becomes your regular car. Yes, yes. You know, your new furniture becomes your regular furniture. Yes, yes. You know, so I think, wow, this is my first. I only have to get 6, and here's number 1. You know, this is like I'm doing it. And so then when we finally agree that worldly things disappoint you after a while, she just looks at me so seriously and says, that's why it's so important to keep on wanting new things. Oh dear, I didn't yet know Patanjali's phrase, missing the point, but that was exactly it. She saw exactly what I saw. So you must have a constant lineup of other desires that you can fulfill to replace the ones that have disappointed you, and then you'll just keep on like that. And actually, Swamiji says here, it's a way of seeking God. Because we're saying, this didn't fulfill me, so I'm going to try this. This didn't fulfill me, so I'm going to try that. And it is a soul drive that moves us that way. A soul, S-O-U-L, soul drive that moves us that way. Because the heart is restless. and the heart knows, I haven't found it yet. So if we have energy, we try something else, and then we try something else. The woman I was talking to had lots of energy. So I try something else. And as Swami said, if you're honest about your experience, we gradually begin to discover that it's not really the color of the furniture or the size of the house, it's the whole concept. That there's something fundamentally wrong with the whole concept. And when we begin to want a deeper truth comes to us, because God is no tyrant. But as long as, there's that wonderful Whispers from Eternity where the devotee says to Divine Mother, you've been sending me playthings and toys, but I want you to know I'm not satisfied anymore. No more fame, no more wealth. You know, I'm not interested in that. You can toss all that into my playpen, and I'm just going to toss it right out and keep screaming until you, Divine Mother, in the whispers, it says, give up your housework of creation. I want your attention right now. And then I love it. It's the devotee in the poem says, if you don't pay attention and come and comfort me, I'm going to scream so loud that I'm going to wake up all your children, and all your children are going to be calling for you. You know, we're threatening mother in that way. I'm going to wake up all my siblings, and they'll all be screaming at the same time. I want you, and I want you now. I'm done with playthings. And this is what the Gita verse says. If you, in whatever form you worship God, God will come to you. And worship means, what is the center of your altar? You know, is divine fulfillment at the center of your altar? Is worldly success? Is family happiness? Are your children at the center? Your grandchildren? Your house? Whatever it might be. What's at the center of your altar? Really ask yourself very deeply and be honest about it. There's no point in pretending to be more free than we are. I was just contemplating just the thought, what would happen if I really had, you know, from one minute to the next, the opportunity to abandon everything, to just walk into the light and walk away from everything. I mean, these are wonderful meditations. You know, what would pull me? What would I lean back and look toward? People who've had near-death experiences, friends of mine who've come, they talk about, one man said to me, it was very interesting, he says, it's just not that easy to get out of your body. He said, all the just sort of entangling karmas, they all just start talking to you in ways that you don't even really know. But the lingering unresolves, whether it's longing or regret, those are the two things. They just sort of pull at you. So it's a wonderful practice to just, well, this is how Swami says at the end of every day, examine your heart for any lingering attachment and throw it into the bonfire of divine awareness. I've shared it in other contexts, if not here. The picture that works for me is my deathbed, because I've been present at a number of times when Ananda people died, so I know exactly what that looks like. I don't know which room I'll be in, and whether I'll be in this house or another house, but somewhere I'll be on this bed. I see my face growing ever more gaunt, and I see myself, relating less and less with the people around me. And I see all my wonderful guru bhais just coming and going, and me just gradually walking away from the whole story. It's a wonderful exercise. See what lingers. Try to actually leave this world and see what lingers. And I don't mean then come out and sever those ties. Just watch. See what lingers. See where the work remains. And then, of course, then we begin to work on that, to see God in the people that we love, to recognize that whatever form the relationship has right now is just a passing moment, that we're souls together, and if this form changes, nothing really changes. It's a wonderful opportunity. We can mourn its passing. You know, whenever I've put on a big event or been part of some liturgical theater or something that we've done, or a beautiful concert, a beautiful spiritual event. You know, this is just so beautiful. And by the grace of God, I've been part of countless such experiences over many years at Ananda. Beautiful events with Swami, just like that. When it's over, there's, the heart says, oh, That was so beautiful. But that's not really attachment. When I said to Swami, when he said, whatever you long for will bring you back again, I answered him immediately saying, oh, sir, I could live those first 10 years at Ananda Village. I said, in a heartbeat. I said, it was heaven on earth. And he smiled. He says, oh, that's different. That's different. And he answers that, and Yes, I think it's coming up very soon. But the action which liberates us from all delusion is not binding. And the sense of delight in that first decade at Ananda was just first coming onto the path, and everything was so new, and it was my childhood. It was my spiritual childhood, and I had a very happy spiritual childhood. Just, it was so free and so wonderful, but it was moving me toward freedom, so the longing for it is the same as the longing for freedom. But there's a natural, a little like, oh, well, that was so beautiful. But that's not quite the same as attachment and desire and fear. That's just an appreciation for what is. Master wept when Sister Gyanamata died. It's always been so telling to me. He saw her merge into the light. He wept because, he said, we'll never be Yogananda and Sister again. And it had been so beautiful. But now it was done. You know, you can rejoice in something and then give it back. Perhaps Babaji manifesting the golden palace for Lahiri. He didn't have to keep it to enjoy it. You know, there it was. It was exquisite while it lasted, and then we give it back. But how many of us are that free? That's what we're working toward. So then number 13, 413, an admixture of the three gunas, the essential qualities, with the diverse karmas of individuals produces the four castes. Though I am active in creation through these influences, know that I, in myself, am ever actionless and unchanging. Well, Swami reminds us that we've dealt with the castes and the gunas elsewhere. But he says, when he says, though I am active in creation, know that I, in myself, am ever actionless and unchanging. Swami gives an interesting picture, which I've heard before, but I never heard of it in quite this way. When you're asleep and you're dreaming, you can be doing all kinds of things. You can be running and walking and climbing mountains and, you know, square dancing and doing all kinds of things. But when you wake up, you realize that you've never stirred from your bed. Even though you felt like you were just doing all these things, they seemed really to happen. I mean, the concept of this world being a dream and us waking up from it and realizing it was only a dream, that's often used. But I never exactly thought of that, where you're dreaming and you're active, but you've actually never moved. You're just there. It's just been happening all around you. And then you wake and you realize it was never there. That's the dream of God. That's something that one just has to meditate and then sort of hang out with that idea for a while and then come back. I just don't know. I don't know what to do with a lot of this, but I have found I do know what to do with all of this. You just don't forget it. I mean, it's been such a process over enough years now where all of a sudden I just understand something. And I'm not moving into a state of realization, which is quite different, but just something that made no sense to me all of a sudden makes sense to me. Just some little tiny perception. Oh, I really understand what that means now. It just comes to us in a new way. So even when we hear these ideas that are just thrillingly incomprehensible, they register. And then as we just inch by inch move toward it, it suddenly becomes, oh, I see how that works. That's natural. I remember when I was telling a group of devotees in Bangalore about the decision I made just to leave everything and go move to Ananda Village, which I just did. I had nothing. I mean, leaving everything was, I was leaving nothing in particular. But I could see that them thinking that was like some big deal when I did it. And it wasn't a big deal at all. It was just the most obvious thing in the world to do. And I remembered in that context, I put these stories together, but let me share it again. When I met this sadhu up in the Himalayas, I was with a group of people, I wasn't alone. And he basically said during the winter, he stays in his cabin and his cabin gets covered with snow, but he leaves his physical body there and he goes in his astral body to spend time with Babaji. And he told us this story. Later I saw Swami who was in New Delhi, and Swami asked me, what did I think about that sadhu? And I expressed to him I was up in his little kutir, up 12,000 feet above Badrinath in the mountains, looking out at the Himalayas. And I said, I don't know what was what. I was so moved by so much that was going on, I couldn't tell whether it was him or the place. But then I, as a contrary to whether to who he to his spiritual potential, I said he spoke about just going in his astral body to be with Babaji so casually. So you know, it seemed like such an obvious thing to do. And Swami said, well, at a certain point it just is. At a certain point you don't say with awe, and then, oh, you won't believe it, I go in my astral body to be with Babaji. If you were like in awe of the whole thing, you wouldn't be doing it. You do it because it's the most natural thing to do. And oddly, this is what I mean about how things stick in your head. When I was just talking to those people in Bangalore, and one of the things they said to me is, what did your parents think? And of course, that's an Indian question, not an American question. But I had to say, it never occurred to me to ask them. I barely told them what to speak of asking them. And I said, it wouldn't have mattered, whatever they said. They could have said yes, no, maybe, anything. It was just what I was going to do. And then suddenly I saw it. I saw it in context, you see. To them, this seemed like a really unusual thing to do. To me, it was the most natural thing in the world. I mean, there wasn't a shred of concern in my heart about it, just not a shred, about my future, about nothing, just not, I mean, not an atom of concern. And of course, quite obviously, there could have been, but where I was standing, it was natural to me. So there's a certain rhythm to our spiritual lives where we have to constantly be hearing, oh, well, the next thing I can do is I can let my cabin be buried in snow and, you know, go live with Babaji in the Himalayas. Today it sounds weird to me, but maybe someday it won't. In this book, I haven't come to it yet, somewhere in this book, Swami gives instructions to Jivan Muktas about how to work out the karma of more than one lifetime through vision. And he explains, it's a couple of paragraphs, he explains exactly how to do it or just sort of gives you an exercise about how to do it. When he was writing this book, and I was seeing it in manuscript form, and I commented to him, I said, this is, you know, very specific about how to do this. I said, this is not going to apply to very many of your readers. And Swami he smiled. He didn't think my remark was silly. He smiled, and he says, yes, that's true, but the ones to whom it is helpful. And all of a sudden I thought, you know, I don't have any idea who Swami is. And two, there's always so much more going on than we know is going on. And again, over many years on the spiritual path, I just try to stay awake. I try to listen. You know, I write things down sometimes. I'll just write down a thought because it's helpful to just write it down. Sometimes I keep it, sometimes I keep it for a while and just throw it away. But I just write it down just to hold it. And then decades later, it'll just come into my head. Oh, right. At a certain point, it's just natural. And that's what Swami's saying to us about God realization itself. It's not like it's an arduous strain. He said at the end, it's the opposite of the strain. You realize that all the strain was to hold the ego together. And that we actually, because you see, we're holding on to this world. That's what the strain is. That's why it's an interesting exercise. If Divine Mother tapped me on the shoulder today and offered me complete freedom, would I take it? There's the disciple who was badgering Master for cosmic consciousness. And finally, Master just looked at him with something of that power and said, if I gave it to you, could you take it? No, sir, the disciple said. Now, I would like to say yes, and I practice trying to say yes. I practice feeling what frightens me and what holds me. But I remember, again, this was a long time ago, but just some little tiny experience in meditation. And I was telling Swami. He told me, don't be afraid. I answered with just like a, you know, like a terrified little cat. I'm not afraid. But I was, because it was unfamiliar. It wasn't natural to me. But at a certain point it is. That's what we're working for. So Swami says, 4:14, though acting, this is God's, this is Krishna speaking, though acting, I am without attachment, nor do I desire any particular outcome from any activity. He, similarly, who is one with me and identified with my nature, is unfettered by the slightest desire for the fruits of action. Well, once again, it's the same story. I mean, I can be calm about the outcome. I was very impressed with myself. I'm going to give myself a little credit. When we were when Ananda was very wrongfully sued by this extremely dishonest woman who totally recharacterized her time in Ananda and turned it into our being an abusive cult that had taken terrible advantage of her. It was all just an extraordinary fabrication, but it was also preposterous. We didn't organize our defense as strongly and as well as we could have, and we did not have the right person representing us as an attorney, and that made it worse. But the end of it, all of it, was there was a jury trial, and they decided that we were in fact culpable to a certain extent. I use the royal we here, the collective Ananda, that we were culpable to a certain extent. And when I sat in the courtroom and the jury came back and announced its verdict, and this woman had won. And she'd won, you know, a certain amount of money, and it was not a small thing. But my first impulse, and I'm very proud of myself for this, my first impulse was this extraordinary wave of compassion for her. I thought, and this is exactly, oh my gosh, not only has she attacked the individuals who brought her to the spiritual path, which is bad enough, instead of being grateful, she worked hard to destroy. So she's not only attacked the source of her spiritual inspiration, she's not only completely lied about everything that happened, but now she's won. She's been confirmed. The world has confirmed her, and she's going to get this relatively large sum of money. Most of it would go to her lawyers, but she's going to get paid for this terrible action. And I thought, oh my gosh, the karma was bad enough, and now it's just going to get worse and worse, because it's going to take her all that much longer to ever get out of this. And, you know, I could have reacted very differently to that, but that's how I felt. And, you know, it was annoying and inconvenient, but mostly I just really felt sorry for her, and I still do. I don't know whatever happened to her, but it wasn't. It's not, you know, to say someone gets bad karma is the same as saying God's going to damn you to hell, so you really shouldn't say it. But I fear that she made some errors and she's going to have to learn her lesson. But you see, that's where we're trying to be. We're trying to be where it's just, if this is what God gives me, whatever it requires of me, I'm going to have to just go forward and face it. And I'm not going to be fearful. And I'm not going to be angry. It's just, this is what's happened. Now, how long does it take us to get there? I mean, in that particular case, it was spontaneous, which was wonderful. In most of my life, it takes a lot more effort. But if we can keep it really clear as to where we're trying to go and what we're trying to do, I mean, being clear on the concept and not missing the point. And you know, a lot of times, the problem is with our wrong attitudes is that we're often highly justified in having them. And that makes it a lot worse. Number 415. Understanding this, the nature of right action, the wise since earliest times have acted dutifully. Be like them, acting without desire for the fruits of action. Then number 416 is, what indeed are action and inaction? Even the wise can become confused on this point. I will explain the distinction, armed with which knowledge you will be freed from all evil. Swami then talks about sabbakalpa and nirbhakalpa samadhi. It was sort of a joke in our community whenever, especially when we were all beginning to, when Swamiji began to ask some of us to also speak on behalf of these teachings. At the very beginning, he spoke, Jyotish, and a few others, but then over time he gradually recruited others of us into this, and many of us felt quite underqualified, to put it mildly. And so we would all try to stay very much within the parameters of what we actually knew. And the joke would always be, don't ever try to explain the difference between sabbakalpa and nirbhakalpa samadhi. Because, well, you're really, like, that was the definition of being beyond your pay grade. To really talk about, you know, the absolute state of oneness with God and the conditional state of oneness with God. Recently, one of the devotees here, we were joking about that. Just that same joke still works. Well, can you explain the difference between sabbakalpa and nirbhakalpa samadhi? Absolutely, he said. One begins with an S and the other begins with an N. And I was like, yep, you got it. You're exactly right there. However, there is just this interesting, simple point that Swami talks about. He said that, you know, in sabbakalpa samadhi, which is a lesser state, but this is the thought. The ego can still hold the thought that I am the one doing this. And he said, in that simple thought are the seeds of delusion, just lying and waiting. And it's just so... It's so marvelous to contemplate. And elsewhere in the Gita it says, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi, and what is night to the worldly man is day to the yogi. I mean, the worldly man wants credit for his accomplishments, wants to be recognized, wants to be loved, wants to be admired, wants to be important. And the devotee wants to be forgotten. Now, you see, this is the delicate thing. It's not that the devotee wants to be invisible. The devotee may need to become world-renowned for the sake of his master, for the sake of the assignment he has from God. But the question is there an I that identifies with it? Or is it just merely an event for which I am responsible? Or as one of my friends said, you know, really wonderful things, inspiring things happen, and I get to be there. And they flow through. You know, they happen around. They're the experience that we all share. But it's not I who am doing it, because there is no I to do it. And it makes no sense at all until it makes sense. And then when it makes sense, you just feel it. You just feel that it happened, I was there, I can remember doing the work, but it doesn't, there was just no... It's not about self. One knows that it happened through me, but not, it wasn't done by me. It just happened through me. Swami would always talk about that. Put your attention at the spiritual eye and Master will just work through you. He would talk about it as if it was the easiest thing in the world, because he wanted us to understand that it was. All right, my friends. God bless you.